From Acast Studios and Western Sound, this is The Score, Season 1, The Bank Robber Diaries. I'm Ben Adair, and this is Episode 3, Who's Your Daddy? How did you discover this bank right here?
You know, a lot of times what I would do is I'd go to areas and I would just, you know, drive around and see if there's possibilities of banks to rob. I used to spend a lot of time down the street here at a friend's house, so I know this area. I finally drove past this bank and I thought, hey, you know what? It's not the kind of bank I rob, which is on the corner, because my whole thing was I like to leave a bank so when I'm followed, people step out of the bank and immediately start swiveling their head side to side looking for cars driving around that who are trying to get in and out of the parking lot because they're looking for a getaway car. Here they would see me leave the bank and not get into a car in the parking lot where all the cars are. That's too easy for them. So I had to park far away. You want to get on a walker?
Yeah, let's go. Let's walk. Let's see what would happen. So now you've parked your car now, and now you're walking to the bank.
Yeah, so I get out of the car. I feel like I've marshaled enough of my will and violence and determination and focus. So I'm going to walk in. I'm going to do what I do. But when I start delivering my spiel, I notice that in the back, there's a woman who's the manager. She spots me, and she realizes I'm robbing the bank. Eyes locked on me fearlessly. I get the money, I spin, and I come out the front here. And I think, all right, I've done my business. So when I walk out of the bank, I start walking here. I look back, and the woman's over there kind of like hiding behind a car. And I'm like, what the hell? She's like gonna try and follow me down the street. And this is why I don't like this kind of setup, because my car's right down there. She's gonna see it. So I look at her and I basically say, like do my finger like, naughty woman, don't do this. You don't want to do this thing again. But just like wiggle my finger at her, like almost like a scold. She doesn't run back in, she doesn't turn around. And I'm like, ah, fuck, I know she's gonna follow me, man, because she's not afraid of me. So I walk down about halfway through this thing there, and I turn around. Sure enough, she's walking. It's almost like a cartoon where she's like doing almost on her tiptoes slowly. Like, she's right here. So now I aggressively look back, and I'm like, I point at her really aggressively, like, you, no, go back. And she doesn't move. So I just turn around, start walking faster, and about three steps, I immediately pivot, and I start running right at her, and I start reaching into my coat, and her eyes is, again, we're like cartoon territory. I went out of her hair, just a crack, and she just looked at me and just spun and just like started running as fast as she could. She was scared. Now I got her. I'm running full speed at her, reaching into my pocket. As soon as she spins and starts running, I take two more steps and then pivot and run straight for my car. I have 10 steps before she's even gonna stop to turn around. She's so scared. I got her scared. So I immediately go to my car, jump in, and make a U-turn that way. That woman, I always like, man, I like admire that woman. There's something, she has some gumption. I hope that's in the DNA, man, because that shit, that bodes well for her family.
Part 1, The Good Life. So after the last episode, I wanted to get some other perspectives on young Joe's family life and childhood. So Joe put me in touch with a lot of his family, actually. Thought I'd play some of those interviews.
Joe was cute as a bug, the kid. He was a talkative, he was very charismatic, even as a little kid. And bright, really bright. And you could tell he was already going to be a leader by the time he was 4 and 5. The kids would follow him. He wouldn't follow anybody. He was the one that took the lead in everything. And I would observe that. And I said, this kid is going to be a leader. This kid has a mind of his own. A funny story is that when he was about 5 or 6 years old, this guy had given me this little tiny pulpit to give to Joe. He was a carpenter and he built a little tiny pulpit, right? Joe used to get his brother and some other kid, and have them sit down for. He taught them. And he would actually teach from the Bible. All he would say was, Jesus says, the Bible says that Jesus says this and that, right? And he was leading this two-child congregation in the backyard, preaching little baby sermons. I'd sit and I'd listen to him, and I say, well, you know, maybe that's his calling. And but I knew one thing. He was meant to be a leader. He was meant to be what he was going to be.
This is Joe's dad, Joe Loya Sr. There was a time before all the abuse that we heard about in the last episode, stuff we're going to be unpacking for the next several episodes, and Joe's dad is going to sound like a villain. Both Joes are going to sound like villains before we're done. But they're not just villains. So before we get into all the ins and outs of victims and assailants, terrors and terrorized, I want to mark this time, the time before. Before the wife and mother died. Before things went too far. When young Joe Sr. was a new dad with all the optimism and promise provided by his new family. And young Joe Jr. was cute and smart and full of potential and hope for the future. They both were.
One day I used to ask him, he'd be playing around and I'd be in the kitchen doing it, reading, studying, learning, and I'd call him and he'd come running. Little guy, okay? He was just 5. So he comes into the kitchen. Yes, Daddy. Hey, you love me? Yes, I love you a lot. I love you a lot. How much you love me? I love you. He's learning his numbers, right? I love you 100. I love you 100. A lot of hundreds. And one day he came home and he looks at me and says, Daddy, did you know that numbers never end? I said, yes, I know that. So a few days later, he knew the routine. He comes in there and I say, how much you love Daddy? This time he doesn't just answer quickly. He thinks about it. He says, the most sweet things for a kid. He says, I love you more than counting goes. I love you more than counting goes. Yeah, yeah. Exactly. Joe was everything you could ever want, I could ever want in a child. He was so incredibly wonderful. I remember that I would come in, he'd hear the door knocking, and he'd be sitting on his high chair, and he was just, you know, sitting there, and then I'd poke my head and go, peekaboo, and he'd go crazy hitting it and laughing and just really, God, I felt so great, so terrific. That's an image that's here, and he grew up and he was just so incredibly wonderful. I was so proud of him.
How did you and Joe's mom, your wife Bess, how did you guys meet?
It was in junior high school. Bess was in my art class. Bess sat across from me, one chair over, and I said, oh, she's a cute little girl. I'm going to get to know her. She kept ignoring me. And one day I said, I know how I'll get her attention to talk to me. So I put a thumbtack on her chair. And when she sat on it, she jumps up and she looks at me with great irritation and says, you did this. I know you did this. I said, well, you're finally talking to me. And it started a friendship.
That started a friendship?
That started a friendship because I said, okay, I was wrong, I'm sorry. I, you know, fell on my sword, so to speak. So we basically became good friends after that. And the rest was history. It was real. When I reflect on my life, I gotta tell you, in many respects, it was the happiest time of my life. Hmm. I had my young wife, 17, 18, 19. We just loved each other. And she told me these wonderful words one day. I called her up from where I was working. I said, hey, don't wait for me for lunch. I gotta work a couple of hours overtime. I'll see you closer to 8:00. And she said, okay. I said, you guys eat and just keep my food warm till I get there. So when I get home, here I am. I just washed my hands and my face, but I haven't showered yet. But I'm hungry. I want to eat. She's got everything there, and she's sitting across from me like we are. And she said to me, "You know what, Joe? If we were to lose this house, if we were to lose our car, and we lost everything, I would still be happy because I have you and my two sons." Boy, I came close to crying, breaking down right there. Because I said, I can never find another woman like her. I mean, wow. And she meant it.
How did you know when Beth started getting sick?
It was because all the chores that she did around the house, she wasn't doing them, and I was finding her every day. She said, "I feel fatigued. I don't just feel tired, Joe. I feel fatigued. I don't want to get up." That was not my wife. That was not her. So I took her to the doctor, and he said she's very ill, but he didn't tell us what the problem was. "She's very ill, and you got to bring her in here. I need to give her a shot every week." So we did that for a long time. And he called us and he said, "I want you to come in. I need to talk to you both." And that's when Bess went in. And that's when he wanted to send her to the hospital immediately. She went from talking with me, joking and laughing on Monday, to her fighting for her life on Thursday and Friday. Just like that. And her stomach just bloated. And that's when it was the most difficult time for me. Through everything, is she kind of went into a state of mind where she didn't know who she was. She'd be talking to me and we'd be having a conversation. All of a sudden, she'd do this number.
Kind of just look up and away.
Yeah, it was like a plane leaving the runway, going into flight. And I could see it coming and it scared the living daylights out of me. There was a time when I had the boys in the back seat and she says, "Who are you?" She immediately went from 1 second she knows who I am. The next second she's threatening to jump out of the car.
Oh my gosh.
My kids are in the back seat and they are just dumbstruck by this. What's mommy doing? They had not seen her in this state. I got her to the hospital best I could, begging her and pleading with her, driving all the time and trying to be careful in the freeway. And it was a tough, tough day. It was a tough time. It lasted for about a month and a half where she'd go in and out of a state of where she knew who she was and where she was at. After, you know, the days turned into weeks, the weeks turned into months, the months turned into years.
And then she just kept getting sicker.
She continued to get sicker, and it was, she passed away on February the 4th, 1971. I was called into the office. Dr. Parsa told Bess, "Tell Joe I want to talk to him." He would do this every now and then. And he wanted to see me this particular time, and I kind of sensed what it might be about because her situation was deteriorating. I could see the difference now. A real difference. And she's far more feeble than she'd ever been. And he said, "Joe, sit down. I've always been honest with you, and you've always been able to handle this honesty." He said, "So I'm going to tell you, you need to go home now, and you need to realize that there's nothing we can do for Bess. You go home and you start making, you know, plans for the future. I don't give her more than 6 weeks." So I said, "Nothing can change?" He said, "No." I said, "Okay." He said, "It's up to you whether you want to tell her or not." I chose not to tell her. Whatever hope she might have had, I didn't want to squash that.
Right.
I said, "I got to suck it up and I got to take it." The tough part came next. Now I got to walk out of the room, and she asked me with a big smile. She had a beautiful smile. She asked me, "Well, What did the doctor say?
Yeah, what did he say?
Oh, he said the same thing. You gotta, don't use salt. And she said, well, even a little bit on a steak? I said, he didn't want you to have salt. But I looked the other way. I told her, you're going to, you know, the doctor said you just got to take care of yourself and I got to make sure, you know, you watch what you eat and stuff like this. But inside, I'm dying 1,000 deaths. Inside, I'm just like, I want to run and cry and I'm hurting, but I got to suck it up. I'm not going to break down. She doesn't need me to be a little weakling here. I got to stand and be strong when she needs me to be strong, not just to think of myself. And so we went home, and Christmas time came, and she had another episode, not of losing her mind, but where she wasn't feeling well, and I knew it was the last Christmas we would be together. And I called Dr. Parson. He said, Joe, you have my permission to take her to Disneyland. They got those wheelchairs. So it was the last time we went to Disneyland before she passed away. And she came alive. That's the best I'd seen her since she got sick. She was alive. She was vibrant. She was talkative. She was really frail. But she was the old Bess. The best of old times. And I said, she's supposed to be leaving me and us. And here she is just... It was as if the last part of that life she had came out. And those would be my memories. The day that I took her to the hospital was a funny day. I kept kidding with her all the way to the hospital. Look at you. Look at you. You got your stomach. I'm too thin. I was thin at the time. And I said, look at it. You look like you're going to have a baby again. You look so pretty. And I said, hey, don't sit over there. Come over here. Sit next to me. And she's just, you know, making these cute faces and like shy and okay. And I tell her, you know, I told her many times, I love you. I really love you. And that's when I learned what true love was about. She laughed. We joked. And I had to leave her up on the fifth floor. So I'd pick her up, and there were always wheelchairs right outside of where we, from the entrance. And so I'd pick her up, put her on there, and took her up to the fifth floor. And I said, I'll see you this afternoon. That was the last time I saw her. Don't forget, I love you. She says, I love you too. And that was it. Mm-hmm.
It's a sweet last memory, though.
Very sweet. Very sweet. She's a good woman.
And then you had to go home and tell the boys.
That was tough. I had to, again, be strong. I couldn't break down. They needed me then more than ever before. And so, after the crying was over, I had to put on the face that said, okay, you can count on me. I'm not gonna leave you. A lot of things changed after she was gone. Mostly for the worse.
We'll be right back.
My name is Keith Cordes. I'm 80 years old, and I've had a pretty varied life, the military, and 24 years as an FBI agent. And now I'm just an old retired coot.
We're going to get to know former Special Agent Keith Cordes later in the series. For now, what you need to know is that he's the FBI agent who put Joe Loya behind bars. I flew to Oregon a few weeks ago and met him in what he calls his Love Me Room. A Love Me Room's kind of like a man cave, but instead of video games and a big screen TV, there's a University of Washington jersey that Keith Cordes wore in the 1960 Rose Bowl. There's a picture of Keith in front of the Unabomber's cabin. He helped put the Unabomber behind bars, too. There are lots and lots of photos and mementos that start over in one corner with his high school years in Long Beach, California. Then they move through college, a couple years in the Army, then a career as a teacher and a coach. Finally, a wall and a half, just about, representing his 24 years in the FBI. A lot of that time in Southern California. What are we looking at here? This is like a, you got maybe like 30 pictures in here of different people, and are all these people who robbed banks that you caught?
Yes, except up here, that's all friends.
Is this a real bank robbery note?
Yeah, yeah. Hand over the money, don't push the alarm,
Don't give me dive,
make it all the bills, you are being watched, hurry, nobody will get hurt.
With a smiley face.
The best one I ever got was, give me all your 50s, your 75s, your 100s, and $150 bills. No offense, bank robbers. It's the dumbest crime in the world. You leave your fingerprints on the counter. You get your picture taken. They give you money that explodes. You leave a note with your prints on it, your handwriting. And during those days, most of the banks limited their drawers to less than $1,000. So the average robber that's going in, bank robber, he's only getting $500-$600 average. Some more, not a lot. So with a drug addict, they got to keep doing it. With Joe, I think it wasn't a game. He thought he was smarter than the average bear. And for quite a while, he was.
The frame with the pictures and the bank robbery note was given to Special Agent Cordes when he retired. It's full of mugshots and surveillance stills of some pretty rough-looking guys. Cars with bullet holes, someone named Shadow Bandit, who's got a giant block letter SS tattoo on his chest. And then there's Joe, wearing a suit and tie, glasses. And up in the corner, at the top of the frame, there's more Joe. It's a copy of an article that Joe wrote when he just got out of prison and was trying to change his life and become a writer.
What did I see in Joe? I don't know. I can see it driving away from the Lakewood Sheriff's substation. He's in the back seat and cuffed, and I'm in the back seat with him, and my partner is driving. We're on the freeway, and we're just talking. And I remember I said to him, you know, when you're done paying for this, you can turn yourself around. You've got the tools. And I didn't even know what those tools were. He just didn't meet the criteria of all those guys on the right where heroin, crack cocaine, you name it, were the driving factor to rob the banks. And he's a good kid. I didn't know how bad the rage and the anger was at that time.
You'll hear this later in the show. Cordes is a really interesting guy, and he's going to play a really pivotal role in this story because when it comes time to put Joe in prison for the bank robberies, Cordes is going to do something really unexpected. I wanted to know why. And what he told me, sitting here in this room, filled with all these memories of a long life full of accomplishments, is that he and Joe, believe it or not, have a lot in common.
All this, I had no help from my father. Everything in here, I basically had to do on my own. He was never around. I was angry with him for years. Did he see me play? No. Did he see me in my marriage picture? No. Did he see me when I was so proud to become an FBI agent? No. He's nowhere around, all the way through. My mom worked her tail off at the telephone company she went to work in 1936 and retired in 1971. She didn't work in Long Beach. She worked in downtown Los Angeles and took the bus every morning at 5:45. She never had a checking account. She never learned how to drive. All this is because somebody else helped me.
There's this one story Cordes tells about that time he played in the Rose Bowl. He'd gone to the University of Washington on a football scholarship, but he couldn't keep his grades up. He was having too much fun. So even though he just played, in the freaking Rose Bowl. He got kicked out.
And after the pinnacle of my football life, when I was ineligible for my senior year, I joined the Army. I was in Germany for 32 months. As I was getting ready to get out, I contacted Coach Owens at the University of Washington and asked if I could walk on when I got done in the military, that I'd save my own money and I would get myself back in school. And he said, talk to me when you get out. So I got out in October 1963 and went up and talked to him when they were down for the UCLA-Washington game. And he said, yeah, that'd be fine. You can walk on. They thought that you had done so much, the Army, getting yourself back in school, that they felt you would be a wonderful example for the kids, because I was 25. And now I'm on cloud nine. The biggest second chance of my life just happened right there. And I think it set the final tone for the rest of my life, looking at second chances. And when I ended up teaching and coaching, a lot of kids needed second chances.
So the guy who's given a second chance to finish college and put his whole life on a totally different trajectory that ended here in this room full of trophies, he made it his mission to look for other folks who might need second chances too. Just a tiny little mercy to help things get straightened out.
My dad was gone for 14 years, 1954, 1968. My wife made me go sit down with him and find out why he left. And we made up and had a pretty good 10 years before he passed away. I didn't have that, the rage that was driving him, that Joe had. I just didn't like my dad very well.
We'll be right back. Part two, Daddy's Voice.
My mom died 1 month prior to my eighth birthday. So I have blocked out a large portion of my childhood, 0 to 8.
This is Paul Loya. Paul is Joe's younger brother. They're 18 months apart.
So I don't have a lot of like clear memory of specific incidents that occurred between 0 to 8. Now, what I do have is I have a lot of emotional feelings and I have substantive memory when it comes to emotions. Like I know how Joe made me feel as a child and how close we were. And I remember him always protecting me. I remember things, him always comforting me. I remember him always being there. I remember him always, he's always had that older brother protective thing going on with me. So.
Is there a story that really kind of shows that you can think of? Or maybe more than that?
I think one of the first stories that I've always been told growing up, and not just from my dad, but from my brother as well, and I've always understood it, is that Joe was never jealous of me. And so many siblings, when there's another sibling that comes into the home, the older sibling is really jealous. And one of the things, and God bless them for this, one of the things that my mother and my father did was they, now that I think about it, maybe it's not a good thing, but they gave Joe the responsibility. Imagine that, having a two-year-old responsibility, giving a two-year-old some responsibility. But they told him it was his job to kind of like protect me because he was the older brother. And Joe, being Joe, kind of understood like he had this role in my life. Certainly growing up, he was very much a protector of me. People knew that he was a bit of he was charismatic. I was the shy kid who hung out with his brother. We moved a lot. So there were all these other variables in our lives. Because we moved around a lot, there was always a new set of friends. There was always a new set of circumstances. There was always these new things that were coming into our lives where we had to interact. And Joe was much more advanced in interacting in these situations than I was. I was much more insecure. I was much more afraid. And Joe knew that. And Joe would always let me tag along because he was my brother. Joe allowed me into his world. And because he allowed me into his world, people gave me that respect. And, you know, I remember I didn't have friends. They were always Joe's friends. Now, years later, even into high school, the friends that I had weren't always my age. They were the friends that Joe would make, and then I would tag along and become Joe's friends. And then we would all be, you know, hanging out, and, you know, lo and behold, I would get friends through that avenue. But it was always because of Joe. And even like when we were going to church, you know, Joe would show up. Joe would show up at a Bible study. And I remember when I first started learning guitar, I was horrible. I was horrible, man. I look back and I was like, I don't even know why I was like I picked up that instrument. But I was like, you know, I was so brand new at guitar. And Joe said, hey, I'm going to go to this Bible study tonight. And I would tell Joe, hey, can I bring my guitar? And Joe would be, yeah, bring it, man. Like, hey, it's cool. You know, maybe you could play in front of people and stuff like that. And, you know, where nobody in my family ever would give me that credibility, Joe always gave that credibility to me. And I remember going to, like, you know, Bible studies with him, and, you know, he'd be out there talking and all, you know, philosophizing or whatever, and I'd be in the corner playing my guitar. And, you know, I don't know why Joe ever put up with me like that, because I was horrible. I was really, really horrible. But, you know, as long as I knew that it was cool with Joe, then it was cool, that I was all right, you know. But that's still, those are the types of things where I can't really articulate, like, say, hey, you know, Joe would come over and, you know, rubber stamp me and say, this is my brother, he's cool, la, la, la. These are just the things that emotionally that I knew, because that's the world that I lived in, was the emotional world. And I lived in a world of, you know, like, am I okay? Am I not okay emotionally? So I lived in that world, and Joe always made sure that I felt okay. There was a story. My dad was charismatic growing up, and you know, we were at church, and because of my dad's charisma, my dad would get offered to be a speaker at some of these church camps. And I went to a church camp with my dad where my dad was the guest speaker, and my dad would speak at these camps and stuff like that. And I remember going, and I didn't know how to swim. And I met one of the counselors, really nice guy. His name was Grady, I think, but really nice guy. And he ends up, you know, everybody's around the pool and everybody's, and I didn't know how to swim at the time. And I remember that Grady threw me in the pool in the deep end, and I had no idea how to swim. And I was like, I don't know how to swim. Grady figured out, like, I didn't know how to swim, and he ended up saving me. But that summer, and I was like 14, it's like 13, 14 years old. This is like a big deal, you know, like I think probably about 13 or something. And Joe taught me how to swim. And that was a big deal. That was a really big deal. And Joe had the patience with me to teach me how to swim. Now, I'm not this great swimmer or anything. I'm not like Mark Spitz, or I'm not this like phenomenal swimmer or anything, but Joe taught me how to swim. And those are just one of those monumental developmental moments in your life where you just know, like, your brother's got you, because I felt safe with him. I was always afraid of the water, always afraid of the water. And Joe made me not afraid of the water. And for that, you have to have an amazing amount of trust in someone. And Joe was that person that I trusted innately, because I knew that he would never, ever let anything bad happen to me.
Joe, we just heard a bunch of stories from your brother Paul about how he was raised to look up to you, how you were his protector. What do you remember about Paul as a child and sort of how your relationship developed?
Being the firstborn and being like my dad, you know, you've heard these stories about how I would, when I was age 7, I would ride my bike with all the little fellas in the neighborhood, and then I would say, all right, everyone, get together, get your bikes here, and let's get here, and I'm going to tell you Bible stories. And I would just tell, I was already, like, preaching these little guys, right? And this is my little brother and his bike, sitting next to his bike in our little wagon, whatever circle. So I always let my brother play with me and my friends because I had to look out for him. Where's the best way to look out for him? Is have him next to me. And the other thing is, having my brother next to me was a way to look out for him, but it was also a way to get my friends, because I was a little leader, I'd say, you guys got to watch out for him too. And so nobody resented that my little brother was hanging out. And he ended up feeling really protected, not only by his older brother, but by his older brother's friends.
Did he need protection?
When my mother died, I was 9, I would walk over to the bed in the middle of the night, and I would go and see if my brother was breathing, because I expected him to die. I expected there was some incredible vulnerability in him, and I always expected he was going to die young. I was always checking on his body to see if it was a cadaver sleeping there or my brother. So my mentality was, my brother is a vulnerable human being on the planet for all these myriad other reasons that have to do with his fragile existence on the planet. He was kind of floating around. He was kind of a fucking shell shock through childhood. So I felt like, okay, you're not as aware as I am. You're not as, like, fucking hip to what's going on in the world. You're just a little dude who just, like, you're at age 5, 4 and a half. Your mother gets sick and you don't see her anymore. She's all over the place. She's a fucking ghost in and out. That little dude was lost.
Joe, the story that that Paul told us about, you know, him learning guitar and you sort of helping him with that and then you teaching him to swim, like they're really amazing stories. What do you remember about them?
Well, I do remember that, you know, so we were raised in a weird way. We were raised in a very artistic home. My dad was learning opera, how to sing like an opera singer, right? And he would go get lessons. And in order to do that, there was like, oh, like in our home, in the bathroom. My dad was always trying to like sound his voice in a way that he was practicing, right? And there's going to be noise because of the practice. Whether you're practicing language, whether you're practicing singing, you have to practice. And that's okay. That's what has to happen if you want to become excellent. This is the years I developed this knowledge way before Malcolm Gladwell did, about the $10,000, just so we know that everyone knows this shit, right? Anyway, but I knew that. So when my brother started playing, he was terrible. Guess what? So was everybody. Everybody at the beginning of anything you start doing, guess what? You're shit. That's what you are. That's what it is to be a beginner. So I was like, okay, this is what has to happen. So when Paul started playing, come on, let's go do this over here. Let's see, like, I ever start getting in the mix. And I knew people would do it, and I encouraged it. And it's funny, as Paul told me the story later, how important that was to him, I was like, oh, that's cool. Because I didn't think I was doing anything other than, like, this is what we do, right? This is just part of it. I didn't see, like, I was doing that. But I do remember the swimming thing. My brother was petrified, man. Fucking water scared the hell out of him. And I took him to the shallow end. I said, here's what you do. And I held him up. I taught him how to be safe from one side of the pool, shallow end to the shallow end, side to side. And just taught him, because I didn't like him being so afraid, so panicky, you know? And I felt like he was braver. And he was introduced to some level of bravery in himself that I think he really loved. I think we all do. I think the brain delights in those moments when you're able to conquer your fear. And it becomes a big moment, a touchstone moment where you can go back. And apparently in his life, it's one of those things, you know, where he remembers when he learned how to swim and he was so afraid of the water. He was no longer afraid of the water.
Do you think you did a good job protecting him? Were you a good protector?
It's tricky. Yes. I protected my brother. My brother's whole narrative about me is that older brother took care of me. Except I have a memory of a time I did not. I was unable to take care of him. And even though later I would come up and clean it up, I still remember the time that I did not take care of him. It fucking breaks my heart. Yeah, it's one of my terrible regrets of life.
You're listening to The Score, Season 1, The Bank Robber Diaries. This has been Episode 3, Who's Your Daddy? Your mission this week? How can you help other people hear this show? I'll give you some ideas. You can text your friends. Send them a link to the show. You could share it on Instagram. You could share on whatever social media sites you like. But really, talking is great. I mean, we're podcasters. We like to talk. And I highly recommend talking to your friends. And as you're talking to them, let them know that they should be listening too. If you can, you can also write us a review on Apple Podcasts if you're there. You can also follow us on Instagram at thescore.podcast. And then we have a website, of course, thescorepodcast.co. Executive producers are me, Ben Adair, Joe Loya, Veronica Taylor, and Susie Warhurst. Producers are Cameron Kell, Haley Fox, and Stephanie Aguilar. Original composition and sound design is by Dan Leone. Production assistance from Annette Ronhell. Mixing is by John Evans Evans. Next up is Episode 4, The Wolf and the Sheep, Part 1.